Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is the upcoming University of Tulsa presidential lecturer, best-selling author, and CEO of the Robin Hood Foundation, Wes Moore. Wes Moore grew up in West Baltimore in the Bronx, where he was raised by a single mother, and his mother sent him to Valley Forge Military School, a decision that Moore says changed the arc of his life. He attended Johns Hopkins University and graduated Phi Beta Kappa, became a Rhodes Scholar, and graduated from Oxford, then served as an officer in the U.S. Army in the 82nd Airborne and served in Afghanistan, and was a White House Fellow to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. But when the Baltimore newspaper announced his Rhodes Scholarship, Moore noticed that there was another Wes Moore in the newspaper that day from his old neighborhood who was convicted of murder. Moore reached out to him, befriended him, and eventually wrote about him in the best-selling book, The Other Wes Moore, which redefines that thin line between success and accomplishment and failure and tragedy. His latest book, published earlier this year, 5 Days, The Fiery Reckoning of an American City, explores the death of Freddie Gray, who died in police custody in Baltimore in 2015. And the protests that followed. That continues Moore's examination of American social justice. Today, as CEO of the Robin Hood Foundation, he runs one of the largest foundations in the country solely devoted to fighting poverty. He'll be the University of Tulsa presidential lecturer, presented virtually Thursday evening, September 10th at 7:30. The lecture is free, and you can learn how to view the lecture at utulsa.edu/PLS. And he's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Wes Moore, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Great to join you.
I want to ask you, before we talk about your new book on the story of Freddie Gray, 5 Days, you know, as protests started up again after the death of George Floyd, there seemed to be an opportunity, just by the egregious nature of that event, that we could break down some of the long-standing police culture issues that surrounds how they police communities of color. But it seems like now, a few months on, especially in light of the federal troop deployments in some cities, that this issue has just become another polarized political issue. What's your view on where we're at today?
Well, I think the horrific murder of George Floyd, it's important to note that it actually is a continuation. That, you know, what we saw from George Floyd was, frankly, that his name was added to a much longer lineage. And then for there are some people in this country who might have looked at the murder of George Floyd and were really taken aback by it. I mean, you really literally watched the homicide on camera. But there's many of us who, you know, not only live in many of these communities, but also have been working on these issues for a very long time, that the murder of George Floyd, you know, was not terribly surprising when you consider the fact that this is we've seen this throughout various communities, throughout Charleston and Baltimore and New York and Chicago, and other areas around the country. And so the thing that we're seeing right now in this moment is that we're now watching a larger chorus of people who are having a measure and a level of demand for justice, right? And if you look at the history of so many social movements that have taken place around the country, the thing that turned them from moments into movements was the fact that you did not just have the impacted community or the impacted population who were screaming for justice, whether you're talking about the civil rights movement, the anti-apartheid movement, women's suffrage, marriage equality. What happened was you eventually had people who were not immediately or directly impacted who were demanding and screaming for justice. I think we're seeing shades of that right now. I think we're seeing shades of that in our society, but we also have to understand that the things that we are arguing for, the things that we are arguing against and combating against, are not simple things. They're not new things. They are things that have been entrenched inside of a system that we're then building out. And so the work of being able to uproot systems is not just hard and complicated work. It is long work, but it's still just work.
I was struck by something you said in another interview. You said, you know, this movement is larger than police justice. It's also economic justice, housing justice, health justice. That makes what is already a tall order even exponential powers more in addressing all of the issues surrounding those complex issues as well.
It is, but it's also important to recognize it as that, right? Because if in this moment what we are demanding for is just about policing reform, then we are missing a bigger point. We have to understand the fact that the issues of systemic racism are things that exist throughout all of our systems. They exist in our education system. They exist in our health system. They exist in our housing system. They exist in our transportation system. And that when we're looking at the impact that systemic racism has had in our society, we have to understand that it has been not just longstanding, it's been deliberate. That's not to play gotcha. It's not to play I told you so. It's to look at the reality. It's to look at the facts. And it's to understand that history and truth and all of it, all of our understanding of where we are right now, that it actually does matter. And so part of the demand, part of the, you know, part of what the push is for right now is not just that we can make reforms within our policing areas. All those things need to and must happen. You know, we have to be able to address some of the longstanding issues, everything from how we address things like qualified immunity and no-knock warrants and the law enforcement order, Bill of Rights. You know, these are all things that have to be addressed. But also, if we ignore the levels of disparity that exist within our society that oftentimes are completely and definitively struck along racial lines, then we are missing the much larger point, and we're missing oftentimes the thing that ends up becoming that the policing failure is simply the last system that fails so many people within many of our communities.
I hear what you're saying about how a moment becomes a movement. When you think of the dogs being unleashed in Selma, there was a universal revulsion to that. Just as we saw when the knee was on the neck of George Floyd, there was also this moment of revulsion. But our highly politicized political atmosphere, you know, has changed that moment into a partisan weapon. I just wonder how we get beyond that when you have a large, substantial group in the United States that says there must be a reason why this happened. This is not what I'm seeing.
Yeah. And I think that what is going to happen as we are then moving forward, part of the challenge is that we're having as a society is that we're not dealing with the same measures of truth, that facts are being disrupted, that facts are being manipulated. And so everyone is coming from a different baseline, and often that baseline that people are coming from is skewed from their own perspective. And I look at different societies that have found themselves at similar type of crossroads. When you look at different societies that have found themselves in positions where you had warring factions and warring factions within the society, that you had societies that actually had the level of truth and honesty and courage to be able to go through a process of really understanding what that society had gone through and what then becomes a pathway to move forward. And whether you're talking about a truth and reconciliation process that took place within South Africa, or whether you're talking about processes that have taken place in Burundi or Rwanda or Northern Ireland or Canada twice or Colombia or Chile. I mean, these are places that have had horrific histories of violence and civil war and warring amongst groups. But they had to go through the process of understanding their own history and their own truth and how they got there as a level setting, as a place to be able to understand that if we are going to move forward, we first have to understand how it is that we got here. That is the most powerful way that is actually turning down the temperature on so much of this. You know, we have to be able to institute laws that do a better job of protecting people. Because I think, as Dr. King said, laws don't change the heart, but they can protect me from the heartless. So we have to be able to do those things, particularly those things that need to be done now. At the same time, we also have to go through a process of being able to understand our history, being able to understand our present. Because to do that is the most effective way that we're actually going to be able to define and refine what our future can actually look like.
My guest today is Wes Moore. He's an author, veteran, investment banker, who's now the CEO of the Robin Hood Foundation, a major anti-poverty organization in New York City that funds schools, food pantries, and assistance agencies. His latest book is titled 5 Days, The Fiery Reckoning of an American City. It's published by One World, and it documents the story of Freddie Gray, who was killed in police custody in 2015, and the 5 days that followed that event in which the city rose up against that death. Why did you decide to write about this? I know you lived in Baltimore for some time in your life. What made you decide to write this book?
Yeah, and in fact, I still do live in Baltimore. You know, Baltimore is my hometown, and the thing that really made me want to go through this process was the fact that we went through a very, you know, an incredibly difficult and traumatic time. Was 5 years ago when Freddie Gray, who was a 25-year-old young man, made eye contact with police and was arrested after making eye contact with police, which, by the way, was the crime that he had committed, because in high crime, oftentimes high poverty areas, making eye contact and running is enough to justify probable cause. And an hour after he was arrested, he was in a coma. A week after he was put in a coma, he died. And so that led to weeks of peaceful protests in Baltimore until one night when it was no longer peaceful. And actually the National Guard was called in, and you know, the city was actually placed under a state of emergency. But it was something that I really wanted to dissect and understand and go through the process of saying, how did we get here? And you know, I had the chance to speak with people from all over the city and all over the state and hear a lot of different perspectives. And so the way that I really wanted to structure this story is to be able to look at it through the eyes of eight people, all from various and disparate and diverse perspectives and backgrounds. Within the city. One was a basketball star turned protester. One was a police major who was actually raised in West Baltimore. One was the son of the owner of the Baltimore Orioles and the head of baseball operations, who decided that the Orioles would play the Chicago White Sox for the first time ever in baseball history. They played a game where the official attendance was zero. And this was 5 years ago, before COVID. Yeah. And that's because he wanted the world to see what had happened in Baltimore. Looking at it from these different perspectives, these different people, a public defender from Oregon who moved to Baltimore to protect the city's children. And that gave me a better understanding of not just how we had gotten there, but then also something that I then wanted to go through the process of sharing with everyone else to add a level of context to where we are right now as a society, and hopefully some perspectives as to what we need to do going forward.
Well, before we hear from those perspectives, first, what do we need to know about Freddie Gray?
I think the most important thing to learn about Freddie Gray is when people were spending time understanding how he died, it's also really important to spend time understanding how he lived and why arguably the most peaceful week of Freddie Gray's life was maybe the week that he was in a coma, because that was also the week that he was surrounded by doctors and nurses. It was the week that he was surrounded by activists and lawyers. It was a week where the whole city knew his name. And it was a week where the whole city cared whether he lived or died. And I don't know a single week in the 25 years that Freddie Gray was on this earth that you could argue those same things. And part of the thing that I wanted to do with this was to highlight the fact that this was a young man, when you look at the life that he lived, when you look at the neighborhoods that were constructed, intentionally constructed in the way that he grew up, that Freddie Gray never had a shot. And when you think about the systems that were in place, the young man who was born premature, lead poison, a collection of other things that we go into inside the book, it's important that we spend time mourning his death and spend time mourning how he exited the world. But it's important also to spend time understanding how he entered the world, and why that experience has to be understood and dealt with as well.
He entered the world a heroin addict.
Yes.
Horribly
his
underweight.
Addiction for much of her life, and he was born addicted to heroin.
Underweight, living in a housing area where he was exposed to lead paint often. Mm-hmm. That's just the beginnings of his life.
That's right. And so when we look at all these other circumstances that exist, you know, and oftentimes it goes back to this idea where people say poverty is a choice. And my point is that it is a choice, but it's not the choice of the individuals who are burdened with the weight of poverty. You know, oftentimes it's society's choice. It's our collective choice about how much pain that we are willing to tolerate in the lives of others. And so when, you know, people say that people who are in poverty or whatever, that they should just work harder. When you look at a life like Freddie Gray, how hard would Freddie had to have worked in order to overcome the challenges that young man faced from his earliest days, from the days when he first was breathing, you know, breathing on his own? How hard would he had to have worked? And these are things that oftentimes are missed in these bigger conversations about how do we address issues of systemic racism? How do we address issues of chronic poverty? How do we address issues of generational inequality? That if we don't look at it from that perspective and understand that, then there's almost this intentional negligence that we are continuing to allow to exist within our community.
Now, of course, the day you mentioned, he said he was arrested for making eye contact with the police and running. I guess the reason he was taken into custody was because he had a pocket knife with a blade that was a little too long?
That's correct. And which they actually did not know about until after he was already arrested and placed in custody. It wasn't seen, but he ended up having a knife that had a blade that was too long, and that's what then justified the later arrest.
And, you know, we're here in Oklahoma, big pocket knives with the long blades. That's a pretty common accoutrement to most people, and yet...
That's exactly right.
Yeah, I mean, and probably in a lot of other places in America. And
That's exactly right.
That took him into custody where we don't know exactly what happened, but we know it was a rough ride. And he was handcuffed in a van and thrown around.
Yes, that's exactly right. And that was one of the questions that people had about what actually happened to Freddie, is that how was someone arrested and in a coma an hour later? How was someone arrested? And then by the time he makes it to the University of Maryland Medical Center, it was diagnosed that he had 3 broken vertebrae and a crushed larynx. And so how does that happen? And that's really what the case in the trial was also trying to understand, because the last things that we saw, the last video footage that we saw was Freddie, was Freddie being dragged into the back of the police van.
And days of protests that eventually turned violent. You had this equal reaction. And as you spoke to the number of people you did in the course of 5 days, the black police major, the young public defender, a young woman who had been picketing the killing of her own brother by police, as well as this leading member of the community associated with the Baltimore Orioles. Did you get consistent stories, or was it almost like a Rashomon tale?
No, in fact, that was one of the amazing things about this for me, was hearing how diverse the perspectives were. And I've always said about 5 days is, no matter who you are, there is someone in this book who deeply resonates with you. And there is someone in this book who you vehemently disagree with. And that's life. That's kind of our reality. And we're talking about the same exact incident. We're talking about the fact that, even as Major Partee, who's a police major, and the one I follow, who was born and raised in West Baltimore, and then rose up the ranks to become one of the highest-ranking African-American police officers in the Baltimore Police Force. But where he would say, I know that none of my colleagues woke up that morning with homicide in their mind, but I also know why, for the kids in West Baltimore, why they don't believe me. Or for Jenny Egan, who was a public defender. Or for Nick Mosby, who was a city councilman who grew up in Baltimore. And as he was walking around trying to tell the kids to go home and there's nothing here, he was like, I know these kids because these are the communities I grew up in. And I live 5 blocks away from the area where I was trying to tell the kids to go home. But I know that when they looked at me, all they saw was a suit. And all they saw was somebody, who was helping to make policies that were killing them in their communities. And so you saw how this everyday reality, this everyday dynamic, and this duality, this dichotomy of how these systems and pieces showed themselves in different ways were on complete and full display within 5 days, and not even just amongst the different people who I chose to follow, but also specifically it was even within them that you're watching these different dynamics show themselves.
I have to ask you, I think anybody who's been to Baltimore, or even you haven't been to Baltimore, you have a picture of Baltimore, and that's really because of this deep love of the community that has shown up in a number of highly respected filmmakers that tend to want to make films about Baltimore. And of course, that goes from HBO's The Wire to the films the director Levinson made a number of films about Baltimore over the years, the television shows like Homicide. You know, I think we have a very skewed picture of what Baltimore is from these projects, but obviously there's this sort of sense of connection to the hometown that you don't see in other cities where filmmakers come from. These filmmakers want to make stories about Baltimore. How does that give the rest of us an accurate, inaccurate picture of this city itself?
Yeah, well, you know, and it's a really important and powerful question, because I do think there is a national curiosity about Baltimore. And part of it is because stories like The Wire and you know, even some of the work of John Waters before it,
right,
where people have this natural innate curiosity of this city by the bay, because it is so emblematic of not just our country's hope and promise, but also our country's fault lines. That it is the birthplace of everyone from Babe Ruth to Thurgood Marshall, and it's also the birthplace of redlining, you know, discriminatory housing policies. You know, it has a fascinating and a really heartbreaking history in the way that we have both promoted and lifted up some of our sons and daughters, and in the way we have completely held down many of them. And so I think that the things that we see in Baltimore are things that actually exist in many communities around our nation, and not just the hope, but also the hyper-segregation. And it's one thing that I think Baltimore has just really, it's a prime example, and it's a prime demonstration point of when we do things right, that there are ways of building up and promoting and prompting real measures of inclusive growth. And when we don't, when we're intentional about levels and measures of segregation and economic apartheid, that it becomes incredibly demonstrable how damaging that is going to be and continues to be on communities, both now, but also communities generations to come.
Well, one more question about this story. Of course, in the wake of Freddie Gray, a number of officers were suspended. They were brought on charges. But what was the disposition of all those charges?
Well, two of the officers were found not guilty, and four of the officers had the charges dropped against them. And it really was, I think, important and very telling as to what we're even seeing right now, and how in many ways Baltimore helped set the stage for the fact that the bar has very much been risen. When people talk about the things that help to, you know, bring down the temperature in Baltimore, oftentimes people talk about when the National Guard got brought in and when the city was put under a state of emergency. That's actually not true, and there's no evidence to back that up. You know, because the truth is that there were going to be protests. That not only did protests continue, the largest protest was actually being planned for that Saturday after the night of the uprising and the night of the unrest. The thing that called that march off was not National Guard troops being inside the communities. What called that march off was when the Baltimore City State's Attorney pressed charges on the six officers, because despite the fact that Baltimore was actually later on would be placed under a consent decree by the Department of Justice because of patterns and practices of intentional police actions, and particularly in Black communities. The thing that we also saw was that there was never charges. Despite that, despite all of that was uncovered by the Department of Justice, not a single officer was ever charged. Oftentimes these things happened, there was a payout, and then people went back about their business. Now, the difference in this case, when you had those six officers charged, was, and I remember being in Baltimore and this palpable community celebration that took place where people were saying, oh my gosh, you mean that people are actually going to be held to account for this? Now, to your point, two of the officers found not guilty, four of them had the charges dropped. And so there still has not been a level of criminal intent justice that's happened to what happened to Freddie Gray during that time. But also you're seeing right now where that bar has now been risen, where this is not going to be simply just about charges being filed. We've seen that even in the cases of recent officers, at least some of them some of these recent cases.
I believe Breonna Taylor has not received.
whose officers are still free, or Jacob Blake.
Right.
So in some cases, like in the case of George Floyd, where we've seen, we have seen some arrests happen, you're now realizing that the demand for justice is not simply going to be about an arrest. The demand for justice is going to be about not just the convictions for officers, but also the demand for justice is that it goes much further than even just the criminal justice aspect of what we're talking about.
And those aspects are?
The aspects is that justice in every form. It's economic justice and it's health justice, it's environmental justice. It's really being able to understand what are not just the root causes of why these things continue to happen and why there's such little accountability for when these things happen. Take the case of Jacob Blake, where you have a person whose children were literally in the back seat of his car. His children were in the back seat, where you have an officer who's pulling onto the back of his T-shirt and unloads 7 rounds into his back. Where it's also going to be about how do we demand justice when these incidents take place and show people that there will be accountability when they do, because right now we do not have any sense of confidence there's accountability for this. But it's also about all the other measures of injustice that are taking place within our society every single day for communities of color and for impoverished communities, for children that are being born having to deal with the weight of poverty and the weight of chronic racism, for the weight of being able to exist in communities where it doesn't take much to know that we have children who are growing up in communities that are neglected and they grow up knowing it. If we cannot think holistically about a way that we can address this and create real levels of opportunity and parity and justice for our society, then we will continue having to deal with it on the back end in a way when we watch these explosions take place, that it becomes not just incredibly expensive, but heartbreaking for our community to be able to deal with that.
Very quickly, in our last minute or so, you're now the new CEO of the Robin Hood Foundation. Is that your active work today in New York City?
Yeah, so that's one of our active works is the Robin Hood Foundation is a 32-year-old organization, and it's one of the largest poverty-fighting organizations in the country. And it really is trying to use every single lever at our disposal, whether it is philanthropy and or policy and or partnerships, to be able to address these chronic issues of poverty and also these issues of inequality that exist within our society. And so everywhere where poverty is either the cause or the consequence, we will find, fund, build if necessary, create if necessary, the mechanisms to be able to add real levels of economic mobility to the families that we serve.
All right. Well, we wish you good luck with that. The name of the book is 5 Days, The Fiery Reckoning of an American City. And you can see Wes Moore when he will be giving the University of Tulsa presidential lecture Thursday, September 10th. That will be a virtual event, and we look forward to that event then. Wes Moore, thanks very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
The upcoming University of Tulsa presidential lecture, best-selling author and the CEO of the Robin Hood Foundation, Wes Moore, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He is the author of The Other Wes Moore, the bestseller, and his latest book is titled 5 Days, The Fiery Reckoning of an American City. He'll be speaking as the University of Tulsa presidential lecture Thursday evening, September 10th, that's a week from Thursday, at 7:30. The lecture is free and will be presented virtually, and you can learn how to view the lecture at utulsa.edu/PLS. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.